Hi, it's Doc and Skip from The Morning Blaze with Doc and Skip.
A little redundant there.
Every weekday morning, we bring you the collision of common sense and comedy.
Okay, now what does that even mean?
It means we discuss current topical stories that matter to people in an entertaining way.
Well, I mean, you and I find them entertaining.
It's anyway, follow us on Twitter and tell us what you learned throughout the program with the hashtag WhatILearnedToday.
That's really just an excuse for us to slack off the last segment, as it's written by you, the listener.
Hear the show on demand anytime at theblaze.com/doc.
That's theblaze.com/docandskip.
Oh, so now you want to be a part of this? Now you...
And now, it's time to Stand for Truth with the host of Stand for Truth Radio, Susan Knoll.
And welcome, everyone, to the program. I'm your host, Susan Knoll. Please check out my website at susanknowles.com. And don't forget to follow Stand for Truth Radio on Spreaker.com, or you can just simply download the Spreaker app onto your phone and take us with you 24/7. Now, we have another great guest for you today, Carl Pittman, who is running for Harris County Sheriff in Texas. Carl came from very humble beginnings in Texas and grew up with tremendous challenges in his life. He joined the United States Marine Corps in July 1981 as an infantry Marine, serving with the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines of the 1st Marine Division at Camp Pendleton, California. After being honorably discharged in July of 1985, he joined the San Diego Police Department and graduated from the 103rd Regional San Diego Police Academy on November 11, 1985. Carl's experience with local Black and Hispanic gangs and the Mexican Mafia led him to become a California Superior Court qualified expert on gangs and narcotics. A business opportunity in mortgage banking convinced Carl that a career change was in order, and he was licensed as a real estate mortgage loan officer in 1993, and later as a real estate and mortgage banker in late 1996, and he formed the Pittman Company in early 1997. However, Carl never forgot his roots as a native Texan and his love of law enforcement and wanting to come home. In early 2001, Carl became licensed as a Texas real estate broker. He also passed the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement and was licensed as a Texas peace officer. In July of 2001, Carl left San Diego and moved home to Katy, Texas, and joined the Harris County Sheriff's Office on August 6, 2001. Carl holds a Master Peace Officer certification, and his website, let me give you that, is carlforsheriff.com. Welcome to the show, Carl Pittman. How are you?
I'm doing outstanding. How are you?
Great. I'm glad that you could be on with us today. I heard about you, and I heard about what you were doing in Texas. I have a lot of friends in Texas, and as you know, I may or may not know, I'm in San Diego. So I wanted to have you on just because of all the connections there. And I know that you're running for the sheriff there. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of come on and tell us all about you. And when people leave here today, I really want them to know who you are, you know, because I get so tired of public figures and politicians just kind of coming on for 5 minutes and saying, you know, this is what I'm running for, but we never really get to know the person, and I think it's so important to know who that person is.
I absolutely agree, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on and share not only my story, but my vision for Harris County as the sheriff of Harris County coming
Perfect.
Up here in 2017.
Perfect. Now, let's start with a little bit, let's go back to your childhood. Let's go way back, right? Let's go back and find out what your childhood was like and where you grew up and family situation.
Yes, I grew up just west of Houston in Fort Bend County, Texas, in a little town called Fulcher. Fulcher was a German settlement when I was a kid, about 300 people there. You know, we knew everyone, everyone knew us. There's nothing you could do without having it reach home before you got home. So it was a very close-knit community. My dad passed away when I was a first grader in 1970. And so it was just my mom and my two sisters and I. We lived in a small two-room house, no running water till I was 15 years old. Heated with a wood-burning stove, had the old outhouse out back. So it was a challenge, particularly in the winter. And those cold Texas nights, if you had to go out and use the facilities, you made sure you really had to go do it. So after high school in 1981, I joined the United States Marine Corps. And again, that kind of took me away from Texas, but never, ever did I forget all of the lessons that I had learned as a child from working hard. We picked cotton, chopped cotton, picked pecans. We did virtually all of the agricultural businesses that you might find in Southeast Texas at the time. And, you know, looking back on that, I am so happy that I was able to experience hard work, because there's a great many folks in America these days that have no idea what that means. And so we were taught to only put our hands out to get something when we had worked to deserve it. So it was a real good lesson for me, and it really set me on a good path.
Now, I grew up in North Carolina, but the circumstances sound very similar to what you experienced. We also, when I was a kid, we had an outhouse. nobody today, you tell them what that is, and they're like, what? No running water? No flushing toilets? Are you kidding me? But did you live in a neighborhood where, you know, you kept your doors unlocked? That's what we did. Were you like that in Texas at that time?
Oh, yeah, very much. I mean, you know, my mother was you know, very security minded, so we still locked our doors, but it wasn't so much because we needed to, because again, it was a very, very close knit community. Most people that were coming to Folsher either lived there or they were passing through on one of the farm roads going somewhere else. So we didn't have a great deal of bad things happening in Folsher at that time.
You know, I don't think anybody today, and it kind of shows you how far we've come. Not in a necessarily a good way, but I don't think anyone today could ever imagine leaving your door unlocked. We left our doors unlocked all the time, whether we were home, whether we were gone, at night, it didn't matter, because there was no crime rate at all. And if you did that today, I think, I'm not even sure what you would wake up to the next day, but you certainly couldn't do that, you know, in the society that we find ourselves in today.
Yeah, you're right. Society has definitely changed, and I wouldn't suggest to anyone to leave their doors unlocked these days, regardless of where you live. But yeah, without a doubt, we are definitely in a very different time.
Now, you wrote a book called The Personal Journey of a Black Common Sense Conservative, and I think you've probably told us a little bit about that book and parts of your childhood. Was there anything else in that book that you didn't mention that you wanted to mention?
Well, you know, the contrast that from my childhood to what we see today, I'm 52 years old, and we have lost so much of what we as young children back in the 60s and even before, of course, you know, came to recognize about America. You know, we prayed in class. When we said the Pledge of Allegiance each morning, going to school, you know, our haircut had to be, you know, we had to have certain grooming standards. And now that everything I just said is just about gone in most school districts. And I think there's a very good link between the way things were then, how they are now, and the problems we are suffering in this country right now. So I am happy to have been raised in that period of time, but I surely wish that we could revisit it in many ways to get ourselves back to where we need to be.
Yeah, the school environment is totally different today than it was. I mean, there's no way back when you and I were growing up that you would even question a teacher or tell a teacher what you thought they should do. I mean, if you did that, number one, you would go straight to the principal's office, and then once your parents found out what you did, there would be more to pay, you know, as parents from the South did, and you would not be getting away with any of that. And I do think it kind of is part of the problem in the school system, because today some of the kids look at it as, well, it's my body, my whatever, I can tell you what to do, I don't have to do anything. And it really does, I think it lends itself to more I don't know, more violence even in the classroom, perhaps, than what we ever had in the past. But now, when did you become a conservative? Was your family always conservative, or did you grow up and say, this is the way I want to go?
Well, you know, it was really just a byproduct of everything I experienced as a child. You know, at that time in Texas, back in the 60s when I was growing up, you know, 60s and 70s, everyone here were Democrats. But it was a very different breed of Democrat than we see today. But as far as being conservative, we were conservative almost out of necessity because, you know, we had to work hard. We had to take care of our own. We knew that the relationship that we even had, our spiritual relationship, our relationship with God, was very important to us because it gave us this guide of how we needed to live, how we needed to conduct ourselves. And it was just so important to us. And again, I compare it those days to these days that we live in right now. And it's a very, very different time. And I think so many of our ills in this country today, had we not deviated from just some of the basic things that we were teaching our kids in school back, you know, 40 years ago, would be very, very different today.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. And, you know, I've written on this before, and I've talked about it a lot. You know, we've seen the progressive left come into the public schools a long time ago, and they were very diligent and very subtly taking over the school system, what was taught in the school system, taking God out of the school system. And I think it's really time that we on the right really start to do the same thing, but in, of course, in a much different way, bringing God slowly back into the schools. I'd like to bring him in overnight, but slowly back into the schools, teaching the way that what used to be taught and giving children guidance, which we really don't necessarily give them all that much guidance anymore. We kind of look at them as, well, they're adults now, and, you know, they're 10, and they can do whatever, but we really do need to continue to give children guidance all the way through school.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, so much of the problem, of course, is starting in the homes. You know, many parents are sending their children to school with some sort of expectation that the school is supposed to be the not only the disciplinarian, but also supposed to be the educators. And we can't have it that way. We shouldn't have it that way. The discipline and the guidance primarily should happen at home. So when that child goes to school, they're going there. So school is an environment of learning. We have fallen off the charts. I think we're probably, you know, 23rd or 24th in the world in education. And in so many ways, what used to make America, you know, just the absolute best, we have lost our way. And we lost our way because we slowly allowed it to happen. And it is eroded. And it is going to continue to erode unless we say stop, no more, and we have to right the ship or we're going to lose this experiment called America. There's no doubt in my mind about it.
Well, and I think part of the problem is with that is that the progressives, you know, convinced parents a long time ago to give up their children to the school, to let the school teach them, and that parents just kind of stay out of the way. We've got this. And, you know, you're right. Parents really have to get back to the way it used to be. I know they're busy and everything else, but they really have to get back and start taking control of the parenting role and being that guide and being the one who teaches and not leaving it up to the school. So, I mean, I absolutely agree with that. Now, let's talk a little bit about your time in the military. What made you go into the service and the branch of service that you chose?
Well, you know, when I was in high school, I can remember, I think it was my sophomore year in high school, we were having a career day, and I will never forget seeing some young Marine recruiters in their dress uniforms. And, of course, we had Marines, we had Army, Air Force, Navy, and not to slight any of the other services, but the Marine Corps stood out to me as just as a visual thing, they looked to be the best. And so as I did my research and thinking, you know, I really didn't have the best opportunity to go to college, so I thought this was going to be a great way for me to kind of step outside of where I'd started. And, of course, as I did my research and looked into the history of the United States Marine Corps, to me there was absolutely no doubt that I should be a Marine. And I had the best of starts because if you'd known my mother, I believe my mother in a former life had been a Marine drill instructor. So she perfectly prepared me to get ready to go in the Marine Corps. So, you know, I entered at a perfect time in history. You know, President Reagan was my commander-in-chief, which I'm proud to say, unlike the commander-in-chief that these young folks have today at the helm, which is very frightening. For me, the Marine Corps was just a perfect fit.
Now, did you go through MCRD in San Diego? Is that where you did boot camp?
I did. I am proudly a Hollywood Marine. I was just out in San Diego. I was just out there last week went out to see my second and newest grandchild, my first granddaughter.
Aww.
So
nice. Congratulations.
My son, thank you. So, I always like going back to San Diego. When people ask me, why did I ever leave San Diego and come back to Houston? I said, well, that's because the weather out there is so boring. So.
Except for today, it's raining, so you'd love it today probably. Now, I found out that you and I have something in common. We both went through the police academy in San Diego. I went before you did, and then you went in 1985. Tell us a little bit about your experience in the police academy and what that was like for you.
Well, you know, the police academy, for me, coming out of the Marine Corps, was very easy. I mean easy because, of course, you know, we had the discipline. You know, we didn't need to go out and figure out how to stand in formation, I'll call it march, but how to drill. Those things were very, very simple. You know, keeping your uniform squared away was, these were things that were second nature to me. Of course, getting in and learning the academic side of learning the business of being a police officer, of course, that was very new to me. But it fit me perfectly because, you know, I'm one of these very kind of right or wrong, left or right kind of people. So, you know, I like the law because there's not an awful lot of gray there. So for me, it was a perfect fit. I enjoyed the academy. I had several of my Marines who had gotten out with me were all in the same class. And so we had a great deal of fun. It was just a good time.
Now, you went into working with gangs and narcotics. Tell us a little bit about that, what you did in that line.
Sure. In 1990, I was working for the National City Police Department there, which is the city immediately south of downtown San Diego. And I was a detective, and I was assigned to a unit called the Judge Unit, Jurisdictions Unified Against Drug and Gang Enforcement. And so part of the duties in that capacity was to monitor some of the most dangerous and violent gang members and also, drug dealers that were being paroled and put back into San Diego. And a lot of these folks, with us having such close proximity to Mexico, a lot of these people had direct ties to MA and the Mexican Mafia. And, you know, and so much of these, that group, which later spun off and became what we know today as MS-13, these folks were hyper-violent. They were very, very bad boys, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And so we were tasked with keeping an eye on them. Whenever they crossed the line, they were immediately taken into custody. We ran parallel investigations with federal agencies. And again, any homicides also that was suspected that they were involved in or if they became a victim of We also conducted parallel investigations with the locals. So it it provided me a great deal of experience in dealing with, you know, some of the worst characters society would have, and understanding that when you are dealing with some of these international groups, which whether it is the cartels, these folks do not take they do not take it very lightly, someone interfering in their business. And so, you know, it was a very dangerous situation. So,
absolutely. Now, what are you doing currently for the Harris County Sheriff's Department?
I am assigned to criminal investigations. I have, because of my political activities, I have literally been, I guess I shall I say, I've stalled out in my current position. You know, I'm not moved. I have a great job. I work with some great people, but I have just over the years, I have not taken any promotional examinations, because if I were to promote, I could be moved and put into some places that would surely affect my ability to do what I do now. And what I'm doing now is much more important to me than, you know, taking a promotion and getting a raise.
And let's talk about that a little bit. What made you decide to run for Harris County Sheriff?
When I look at, as we've spoken about, where the country was and when I was a child and where it is today, and I had to take a serious look, particularly after the 2008 presidential election, the national election, I took a serious look at where the country was, and I knew that we were headed in a bad place, and we were headed there very quickly. And looking at my experience, my background, business, law enforcement, military, I believe that the best way that I could give something back was to be in public service in a different way. And as the sheriff of the third largest sheriff's office in the United States, I could have a great influence on many things, not only setting policy for the agency, but bringing to the absolute forefront the Constitution. So many law enforcement officers, you know, they take the oath, or in fact, all of them take the oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and I think many of them do it with the best of intentions. But unfortunately, we have this gap in that oath versus what is actually done each and every day in law enforcement. And so for me, it was kind of coming full circle from that oath I took when I was 17 years old, when I joined the Marine Corps, when I entered the Corps, that it meant something to me. It, you know, no one ever said to me, Carl, this oath is going to expire when you leave the Marine Corps. And so that oath never expired. So I took it very seriously, and I absolutely knew that just the way that I was built, that I could stand up and I could guard the gate, shall I say, and that I wasn't going to waver in my duties. So I knew I'd be a perfect fit to be a good county sheriff.
Now, what do you think are some of the biggest problems that are unique to Harris County that you could effectively deal with?
Well, one of the big issues here, the city of Houston sits almost entirely in Harris County. The city of Houston, if you look at any list that's being honest, is identified as a sanctuary city. We have a serious problem with illegal aliens here. We have a serious problem with human trafficking here, narcotics, all of the things that are the byproduct of allowing folks in that we don't know who they are. And one of the things that we have to do is we really need to take the blinders off. We really need to get in there and start to enforce the law. This is not a situation where we need to go out and create a lot of new laws to deal with the problem. We actually need to have the heart to go in and deal with these problems. When I think of just the human trafficking side of it, when we've got young girls from all over the world, a lot of them right here that are American citizens that are either runaways that end up in the sex slave trade business. These are horrible things that most Americans, if we showed it to you, you would say, no, no, we must do something about this. And so when I look at that issue, when I look at the issue that, you know, the jails have become the mental wards of the country now. We don't have mental hospitals per se anymore. We look at this incident that just happened, you know, with this young man. I mean, they're saying that maybe there's a mental illness situation there. I don't know. Here in Texas, one of a member of our office about 5 weeks ago was executed by a gentleman, again, that is claimed to have mental illness. So, you know, these are things that we have to do something about. You know, if we watch conservative news or news in general, we hear lots of people talking about doing things. Well, I think we need to get beyond talking about it and do something about it.
No, and I absolutely agree. And a long time ago, at least in California, we started turning people with mental health issues out onto the streets, and we weren't taking care of them the way we should. But I also think that we also need to call things what they really are. And I think in this administration especially, we're not looking at things and calling them what they are. I think, you know, what happened in Oregon, yes, you know, could there possibly be some mental health issues? Yes, there can. Is there something else? Is this person, you know, radicalized? Yes, I believe that's also a possibility. And we don't even talk about those things. And about the man who killed officer or Deputy Goforth in Texas. Was he mentally ill? You know, possibly. And I believe there are also other things that probably made him do what he did. So I think we have to really start looking at everything and stop trying to be so politically correct as we are in this administration. So, and I wanted to ask you too, what is your... You know, what's your opinion on having all these schools as gun-free zones? What would you do differently, or how would you run the schools?
Well, I think, you know, I wrote a post out on social media on Facebook a few days ago, and I equated, and most people here in Texas will surely understand this, you know, the opening day of deer season here is just get out of the way. I mean, you're going to have trucks headed out. High rate of speed, lots of ammo, ready to go hunting. And what I equated it to is, can you imagine what would happen to the popularity of opening day of deer season if the hunters knew that the deer were armed and they'd be shooting back?
Right.
And I believe that whenever you create a location that guns are not allowed, the only individuals that are going to follow those mandates are the law-abiding people. So that means that the people with bad intentions, whether it's, you know, formed in a sane mind or an infected mind, that is their hunting ground. And I think to tell anyone that we're going to put you in a situation and you cannot protect yourself, that is not a very American way of doing business, in my opinion. And so... My issue with gun ownership and carrying guns is one thing. Be trained with it and be responsible with it. But other than that, I am an absolute supporter of the Second Amendment. I don't like the idea that people even have to go out and get a license to carry a gun, because I think the licensing issue is simply a mechanism for the government to raise money. It has nothing to do about whether that person has the right to carry the weapon or not. I think the Second Amendment has covered that a long time ago.
And I think you're absolutely correct. And I think also that's another reason that why we have to look closely at the people involved in these shootings and these massacres that we see, because plenty of them, it seems, have the wherewithal to know what's a gun-free zone. So they're mentally capable, at least, of knowing that. And that goes towards their mental illness issues, perhaps. Because if you know that's a gun-free zone and you're going there because of that reason, then you're not so mentally ill that you don't know a lot of things that you're doing. So now, I want to ask you a question. A lot of times people are so concerned about their Second Amendment rights. And I've written an article today, and I have it up on the Blaze, about Second Amendment and questioning whether Obama is playing sort of a shell game with our Second Amendment rights. And I won't go into the article. You can go there and read it. But people have said, you know, the law enforcement is the only thing really standing in between us and perhaps an order someday coming down from the president that says, okay, you know, Sheriff, go out there and disarm the public. What are you going to do if that happens?
Well, for me, that's a very, very simple thing. The oath that I took to protect and defend the Constitution, that is a very clear thing. The reading of the Second Amendment, you know, those words shall not be infringed, that is a very clear thing to me. And, you know, Mr. Obama has come up with all sorts of unconstitutional mandates that he has presented to us in the form of executive orders. I think it's embarrassing that the Congress is not, you know, actually put on their big boy pants and dealt with these things. As whether I am the sheriff of this county or not, I personally will not assist or be a part of any of that. And if I am the sheriff of this county, no such mandate will ever see the light of day of enforcement here in this county, period.
That's really good to hear. And I wish that more people would come out and say, this is what we're going to do. I think that would make people feel a lot safer and a lot better about their Second Amendment rights and what local sheriffs and police departments would do in that circumstances. And used to, you know, that was so far-fetched, you wouldn't even bring it up. But today, I think we really do have to start looking at things like that because of where we seem to be going. And I noticed that last time, and you probably noticed it too, you know, when President Obama came on right after the shooting and actually politicized, admitted to politicizing the shooting, it was different. He was very angry, angrier than I've ever seen him before on the subject. And I think that I believe that he's going to be moving forward with some other things that we are going to be seeing instituted in the next couple of weeks, if not, you know, sooner than that. So I think we need to keep our eyes open on that. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about Baltimore and what happened over the summer with the, you know, the riots and the looting and all that. Do you have any perspective on how that could have been handled better in Baltimore than it was?
Well, I think the mayor of Baltimore sold out a lot of people. I think she sold out the community. She obviously sold out law enforcement. But simply speaking, from a law enforcement perspective, here is what I believe: had this been done, we would not have seen the incident in Baltimore grow to what happened. On the day that that civil unrest and looting broke out, this was the day they were burying Freddie Gray.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting to me. And again, I'm saying this: I do not understand exactly how the flow of government there in Baltimore works and what is the actual jurisdiction of the sheriff. But if the sheriff operates there like the sheriff should in most counties, the sheriff should have been aware that that funeral was taking place, should have been aware through intelligence that was available to have placed the entire county's law enforcement, not only the sheriff, but all of your municipal law enforcement on tactical alert.
Right.
And been prepared for this to happen. You know, I was a sergeant in there in National City when the Rodney King riots broke out in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even though that was a horrible, horrible thing we saw in L.A., had L.A. Police Department and L.A. County SO not been on tactical alert, it would have been far worse. And so you have a law enforcement agency there in Baltimore that, I think they were standing by, but they were not standing by properly. They knew where the problem was most likely going to ignite. They should have set up a perimeter, and at the very moment civil unrest began, they should have started to close the loop. And, you know, when you shut something down, you know, I'll equate this to what firefighters would understand quite easily. If you have a grass fire, the faster you get there and you get water on the point of origin, the faster you will get that fire under control. And so by not being able to move in quickly, and in this case you have a mayor that actually had the audacity to tell these law enforcement officers to give these looters space or something to that effect.
Space to destroy,
you know,
yes.
Yeah, I am shocked by that comment. I wonder what the insurance industry back there, how many lawsuits you might see come against the city of Baltimore for basically calling off the police to go in and protect property. The way I would have done it is would have been prepared and not afraid of going in and taking people into custody in a very rapid fashion and shutting that down.
Well, it almost seemed like she wasn't even allowing them to do that, because here you have the police officers in riot gear with bricks being thrown at them and everything else, and they were making them retreat. I mean, it's ridiculous from just an aspect of watching it on TV, what I saw. It was almost like the mayor said, hands off, don't touch anybody, don't let them do whatever they want, and just keep backing up. And she did that, it seemingly, for a very long period of time. And then there was a certain point where it was like, okay, well, now go in there, move in there and get those people and stop this. So I think she really made the problem a lot worse for law enforcement by not allowing them to do their jobs in the very beginning. So, I mean, probably a lot of backroom stuff we'll never see and never really know, but she really turned a situation into something that, like you said, you know, could have been resolved quickly and put out quickly, but not under her watch. That wasn't going to happen. You know?
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a lot of things that were going on behind the scenes that we're just never going to be privy to. You know, I was shocked at how quickly the city moved to settle a wrongful death action that had never even been filed.
I know. $6 million.
Yeah, that's a bit unique. You pay a lawsuit off before it's even been filed. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can come up with all kinds of ideas, but they're just my own ideas. So at this point, I'll keep them to myself, but that's interesting.
No, absolutely. But I've never seen that either. I've never seen a city settle a non-existent lawsuit and pay out before we've even had a lawsuit or know what the facts of the case really are, you know. So yeah, it was done so differently, but I think, you know, and I would say to people, keep your eye on Baltimore, because I think the Baltimore area, the city of Baltimore, the mayor and other people there, I think there's a connection between the Obama administration. Let me just say that. You'll find out more if you go read my article, but I really do think there's a connection, and you're going to see a lot happening there. So keep your eye on them. Now, for those of us who don't live in Houston, can you tell us a little bit about the culture of Harris County? What's it like to live there? What are the people like? Things of that nature.
Well, you know, Houston is a very dynamic community, Harris County. We've got, at the last census count, we're about 4.2 million people in the county. I believe the city of Houston is currently the fourth largest city in the country, and it is really an international city. I mean, with the Houston Ship Channel, we've got now the smaller of the two airports is now adding an, you know, international terminal, so we effectively here in the next few months have two international airports here in Houston, both in the city of Houston. And but again, we still have that very, very southern charm. We've got great people here. Law enforcement has just an incredible amount of support here. And hands down, we've just got some real, real solid people here. I think what we're seeing is over these past few years, the oil and gas industry here in Houston has done quite well. I mean, right now we surely would like to see the barrel price for oil go back up a little bit. But we are probably more successful than most other communities in the country. And so that has become a very interesting draw to have people move here. So our population is growing. My fear is as our population grows, people are leaving these depressed places, Detroit, Chicago, and places like that. And they're coming here for our jobs, and that's fine. But unfortunately, I believe they're going to bring some of their very liberal political ideologies with them. So we'll just have to kind of wait and see how that plays out. But all in all, this is still a outstanding place to live. If you're in Texas, you did something right. So that's how most of us think about it.
That's really great. Now, let me ask you, why do you think that you would make a better sheriff than your predecessor, Sheriff Adrian Garcia, and the current sheriff, Ron Hickman?
Well, you know, we'll address Mr. Garcia first. He obviously is running for mayor of the city of Houston, and so he is not in the picture. But if you look at Mr. Garcia's experience, he did very little as a law enforcement officer, had virtually no business experience, and he spent a great deal of his time worried about his political future and where he was going to go next. He never really focused on being the sheriff of the county, unless it was somehow going to help push him along up the political ladder. In my opinion, whenever you run for an office, that must be at the very top of your list of priorities, is to do a good job for the people who have put you there. And I absolutely know I will do that. I do not have an extra, political thing that I'm looking for. I do not want to run for Congress. I surely do not want to run for president. I've had people suggest that one day I'd make a great governor. I don't see that, but I absolutely know in my heart that I want to be the sheriff, because I know the importance of a constitutional sheriff. I know what sheriff can get done. I look at a member of Congress. We've got some pretty good members of Congress that are, from here around Texas, but any one or two of them, they can't do very much because, again, Washington's in gridlock. But as a sheriff of this county that sets policy, that can absolutely stand against federal overreach in this county, that's important. And I know I can get that done. And so right now, Harris County does not have an elected sheriff. We have an interim sheriff, right, who has been put in place. I'm not quite sure why, but that wasn't my decision of why they chose the current. But this is an office that belongs to the people, and it is up to the people to elect their sheriff. And knowing that the attacks that our Constitution has come under, and these are not new things. When we go back and look, we can go back and even look at some of the things that happened when George W. Bush was in office. The Patriot Act, there are some very scary provisions in the Patriot Act. Right. We look at the National Defense Authorization Act. There are some really scary things in there, particularly with Barack Obama as president. So, knowing that you have someone that, as I say quite frequently, is going to guard the gate, that is not going to let the bad people in, that is very important, because a lot of people will run for office and tell you anything you want to hear, and amazingly enough, get the office and their spine just evaporates. That's not me. I'm not built that way. And what I stand for, I stand for, and it's not for negotiation. So I'm absolutely sure that that the people of Harris County will be happy with me as sheriff.
Now, I recently read an article about the fact that Harris County should stop jailing small-time drug offenders under the First Chance Intervention Program. Can you tell me your thoughts about that, a little bit about what the program's about and your thoughts about that program in particular?
Well, that has been a back and forth argument for a long time. Now, the answer I could give you is based upon my many, many years in law enforcement. A lot of your as they would like to call your small time drug users, a lot of these people, they're not simply drug users. A lot of these people, they're your car burglars, they're your house burglars. That they will do all sorts of petty crimes to, of course, be able to find the funds to satisfy their drug need. But in general, when we're dealing, years ago as a police officer in Southern California, there in San Diego, small amounts of marijuana to clog up the criminal justice system by putting someone in jail for it, in my opinion, has just outlived its usefulness. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Of course, it's still against the law, and until the legislature acts on it, to change that, I think it can be satisfied just as effectively as writing someone a ticket for a speeding violation, in my opinion. To put people in jail for these types of things, again, based upon the number of occurrences that we see happening, unless we want to build a lot of really, really expensive jails, I think we ought to seriously rethink that.
Yeah, and I think the program has some validity. I mean, there actually what I read was that it's more or less gained focused on young teenagers, you know, who are caught with marijuana or something, small amounts that maybe have no criminal record at all. They do this one time, and instead of going to jail and giving them a record and all that, you know, they put them through this program. And I can see that, but it seems like now that they want to expand that program more, and you're talking about older people, and you're talking about, you know, maybe bigger amounts or different types of drugs or something like that. And I think, you know, you're right. It's hard to build a facility that can house all the people that would be in it if you arrested everyone and jailed everyone. But I think you have to be careful because, you know, again, you get progressives that say, oh, come on, let's just let this one slide, or this guy's only done it twice, and, you know, let's let this person slide. And you are talking about people that commit other crimes. And I think in California, it's a pretty good example that we're letting these people who are supposedly, you know, first-time offenders, or they're not that bad, but we're turning them back out in the streets, and we're seeing the crime rate start to go up in California. And California being so liberal, they're going to push it to the extremes, of course. But so I think, Justin, you know, for Harris County or anybody else that tries to do this, I think you really have to look at that and make sure that if you're going to do it, you keep the parameters of the program to certain people, and that's it, or else it's going to be out of control.
Well, yeah, you're right. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, there is such a push, even here, you know, in Harris County, you know, that there are people that are pushing real hard to just completely make marijuana illegal. And I know a lot of these people. I think they're good people. I think that they haven't really been able to step far enough away from the issue to see all of the, I guess I'll say, the unintended consequences that would come from that. I think we need to take a look at what's happening in Colorado. And I think, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time so you can get a real accurate look at that. But there are some problems that come along with drug use in general that we just probably could do without. And I think we'd be smart to slow down a bit before we jump off that cliff.
And I think, too, with drug use, I mean, it really starts in the home and very early. You can't start teaching kids about why they shouldn't use drugs or anything else when they're in middle school and high school. It's too late. It really is too late. It's almost too late now in elementary school. But parents have to, it goes back to what we talked about earlier, parents really have to start being the parents that look over their children and see what they're doing, see who their friends are, what their activities are. And it takes a lot of time and effort. And when you have two people who are working to try to put food on the table, that's where things start to get out of control, I think, with the kids. But somehow we have to rein that back in and get the parents more involved at a really an earlier age so that we're not talking about things like this, putting Band-Aids on issues when we get to a certain level.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, you know, society is, you know, every time we accept something that we know is wrong, when we accept it, we can almost bet whatever is the next step beyond that is going to come. And that's kind of the that's what we see happening, you know, in many different areas in our society right now.
Yeah, it's kind of the old adage, you know, give them an inch and they take a mile. And then
that's
exactly
it.
What we're seeing. Now, did you know Deputy Darren Goforth from your...
I did. I had known Darren effectively since he came on the department. The area of responsibility that I have investigated, responsibility of, that is an area where he patrols. So I would read a great many of his reports and would correspond with him from time to time if I needed additional information or had questions. So that was a very, very tragic situation, just a you know, if you're in law enforcement, you know, you're going to see officers die in this business. I mean, that's
right.
Going to happen. But the manner in which and how this happened, I think it was just something that really caught everybody by surprise. I mean, this officer was not at the moment, doing anything when it happened in a law enforcement capacity. He was at a gas station, and someone decided that they had a right to take his life, and that's sad commentary.
Well, and he didn't even have a chance. He didn't even see it coming, you know. So
no.
Such a horrible, horrible thing. And the person, do you know what's happening to him now, the suspect?
Well, he is still, of course, in our jail with no bond, and the case first investigation is still moving forward. I think a lot of people really, really would like to know if there is a motive, because at least that would be able to let you make some sense of it. But as of right now, to my knowledge, there's not even been a motive that's been established. So right now, it's just a mystery of what was going on in that man's mind.
Wow. Now, I wanted to ask you, we talk to people a lot of times when we say, who, when you were growing up, who did you look up to? And we know that, in talking to you today, that you've looked up to your mom. Who else, if you can think of, people that you knew personally, or people that you saw in the news or in politics or in church, elsewhere, that you looked at and admired and it helped frame who you are today? Who are those people, and how that did that impact you?
This may sound a bit like I had a very limited exposure as a child, but, I tell you, every single bit of who I am and what I believe is really blame it on my mom. I mean, good or bad, because when most kids were, again, when I lost my dad at such a young age, and I knew at that age that mom became everything. Because what my fear was, if something happened to her, what would happen to my sisters and I? And I was the youngest. And so, when most kids were running around, with boys my age who were thinking, Superman or Batman or whatever was their heroes, to me, it was my mother. And what I saw her go through, and what I saw her, how hard I saw her work and sacrifice for us, I mean, and there were other people, obviously, that had some influence on me, but every time I get to tell anybody that my mother was my hero, that's who my hero is.
And I bet she kept an eye on you. As busy as she was, she probably knew where everybody was, I'm guessing.
Well, it was one of those things where my mother was a very loving woman. She did not believe that we needed to be, spanked for everything that we did. But I can absolutely tell you, she had some ways that she would do things, and due process wasn't exactly a part of it. I can recall when she knew she had to go to work, especially if she was going to clean house or something on the weekends, and she'd leave us in that little house. She would line us up and tell us that then she would give us a little bit of a spanking. And she would call it, I'm going to give you a taste.
Yep.
And if you got out of line while she was gone, when she got home, she was going to give you the rest. Mm-hmm. And so, I can remember telling my children that, and of course they thought that was the funniest thing in the world. I almost wish I'd employed some of that on them. But but it was one of those things where when I look back at it, my mom took the best of what she had with a third grade education. She couldn't read. There were fears that she had that I can't even imagine. And she did everything she could to make sure that she got us to adulthood and we were good and productive adults. And that is something that I will forever be grateful for.
Well, and, it sounds a lot like, I'd have to say, a lot of Southern women, a lot of Southern mothers. Again, I say that because I grew up in the South, and I'm not putting down any other mothers, but Southern mothers, they want their boys and their girls, to grow up and be outstanding citizens and productive citizens. And it sounds like your mom was doing that. And, God love her. I mean, without somebody else to help her, she had to be everything to her kids. And it sounds like she was and did a great job and brought you to the place that you are today. And I think that's really fantastic. And, God love her. I'm glad you had a mom like that. And I want to ask you now, we have about just a few minutes left. How can people help you get elected?
Well, I'll cut straight to the chase. You know, we have to continue to raise money, and I am very fortunate that, you know, that some of the exposure that I get because of not only my points of view, you know, being a strong, very strong-minded black conservative, I get quite a bit of attention. So I would ask everyone to visit my website, carlforsheriff.com. Please follow me on Facebook, Carl Pippen for Sheriff, Harris County Sheriff 2016. I am everywhere. And, you know, we get money from all over the country. You know, I've been endorsed by Sheriff Joe Arpaio out in Maricopa County, Arizona, endorsed by Sheriff Richard Mack, founder of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, even endorsed by Ted Nugent. And so what I believe in is it's just not for sale. It's not going to change. So, you know, if you support me, if you like what I'm saying now, you're never going to have to say, well, God, I remember when that guy used to believe in this. That's not going to change. You know, I want to make literally loving America and loving God cool again. And I think if we do that, this country will be just fine.
Well, I can tell you, Carl, based on the conversation that we've had today, if I were in Texas and able to vote, I would certainly vote for you. I really mean that sincerely. I'm glad that we got an opportunity to find out who you are as a person. And again, I think it's so important for people when they're voting for someone to know exactly who they are. And I know that people in Texas, if they choose to vote you in, that if you do think about changing, and I don't think that you will, but if you ever thought about changing, they would be there to say, hey, Carl, you know, we're going to put you back in line because you said, you know, this and that. So I have a faith in people in Texas, too.
Well, and you're absolutely right. And that's a great point. You know, a lot of folks we see serving us in various offices from the local level to the national level, they said certain things that they haven't done. And I think that the people who put them in office should remind them of it. And if you don't get their attention, bring them home.
Absolutely. We're tired of having somebody say something and then not do what they say they're going to do. And I think the American public is just absolutely done with that. And I'm hopeful that people in Texas will see that about you and vote in somebody who means what they say. And then they actually follow through and you do what you say that you're going to do. So I'd ask everybody to go to carlforsheriff.com and in the Facebook places that you said to go, the Facebook pages, I'm sure they can probably find that on your website. And make sure you get out and tell everybody about Carl Pittman. Let them know why he should be sheriff. And just because you're not in Texas doesn't mean that you can't help. You know, social media allows you to be able to get the word out everywhere. So you can tell people who's sitting there in Texas that may not know about Carl why they should vote for him. So please get out there and do that. And Carl Pittman, thank you so much for coming on today. Thank you so much for being who you are. And I wish you the best of luck in getting elected as sheriff of Harris County.
Thank you very much, Susan, and God bless you.
God bless you, and you're welcome back anytime.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. So there you have it. What a great guy. I mean, seriously, I can't – it's so refreshing to listen to somebody who's not ashamed of telling you who they are, who really puts it out there and opens up and tells you who they are as a person, what their beliefs are, what they're going to do for you. He doesn't sound to me like the typical, you know, quote unquote, public figure politician who's just feeding a line of whatever just to get you to vote for him. I know from the beginnings that he came from, I believe what he's saying. And I know Southern, like I said, I know Southern mothers, and I know that they do an excellent job for the most part in trying to keep their children, you know, keep reminding them who they are and their value and the good that they can do in this world. And it certainly sounds like, from what we've heard today, that Carl is that person and learned that from his mother. What a great woman she was, and what a great man Carl Pittman sounds like to me, and I think you probably feel the exact same way. So I would encourage you, get out there, tell everybody about Carl Pittman, encourage them to go to carlforsheriff.com and learn more about him. Until next week, everyone, take care, have a great week. We'll see you back here, and God bless.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. Looking for quality auto parts for your vehicle? Shop one of the 126 Los Angeles O'Reilly Auto Parts stores. You'll find we have convenient locations, thousands of brand name products in stock, extended store hours, everyday low prices, and well-trained professional parts people. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.